വരുന്നു.
Good evening. I will be talking about gravitational radiation only in the end. So, but this is about an astrophysical scenario, and you may wonder why I'm giving an asset colloquium on it. So, let me explain that in the next slide. So, this is a topic, nothing to do with gravitational waves for the time being. I will give an introduction, and I will try to explain why we got some press coverage. These days, those who work in classical relativity tied with observations demand press coverage, and so this is something similar in that aspect. More importantly, this established very strongly that there is a quasar out there, 1 gigaparsec away. It actually contains a massive black hole binary, and that happened because of this effort we pursued during the Einstein centenary year 2015, during October, November, December. This was done with Maury Walton and his friends, and this is why I'm going to give an asset colloquium. We will require very sophisticated instruments in the near future to probe deeper into the system, and I will try to give a glimpse of that. I'm not part of any of that. Okay, so why the popular press coverage? American Astronomy Society commissioned a popular article on this piece of literature, and they call this as Dance of Monster Black Hole, and this cartoon summarizes this talk. So this is what we actually see. That's a stellar like object quite far away, and we are actually seeing the jet. Okay, and additionally we see some sort of a flare. I will explain that to you. With this observation, we could argue that it actually contains a black hole binary, not the one LIGO discovered. We are talking about a billion solar mass black hole binary, and we will give the explanation. And more importantly, for a theoretical point of view, this was actually predicted almost 6 years ago. So that's nice from a theoretical point of view. Okay, so this is the paper I will be trying to cover with sufficient background. I will not go into the technical aspects of some of these, which I'm not really a master of. So we were able to measure, that's very important, measure the spin of a massive black hole for the first time, thanks to this flare I was referring to. And this was actually predicted back in 2010 in that paper. In fact, we actually write in the abstract that timing of the 2015 outburst is a strong function of the spin of that big black hole I'm talking about. In fact, we actually say that the spin will be 0.36 of the maximum value allowed in GR, which is 1, if this flare or outburst begins somewhere in early November, and it will be around 0.2 if it happens say later in January 2016. So that's roughly a year ago, actually somewhere in end of September, Maury asked me to kind of organize this campaign, so write some nice theoretical document saying that general relativity, gravitational waves, this, that, which is impressive, so that people will share their telescope time to us. So that such a document was created. Okay, good. So let me go back. What is this OJ-287? Well, it's essentially a speck of light that's 14 magnitude in the constellation of Cancer. If you can see this very clearly, that's the constellation of Cancer. Out there, it's very close to the Gemini twins, okay, and it's very, very close to this Beehive cluster. So what's the big deal about it? Well, interesting thing, if you can again, that lies very close to the ecliptic, and that's very important. So let me go back to that. Again, in the constellation of Cancer, very close to the ecliptic as expected, and near the Gemini. So essentially, you will not be able to see this during June, July, August, because the Sun comes in between. So, good. What did we predict? So what I am plotting here is the V magnitude of this speck of light in the constellation of Cancer as a function of time. And if you look above there, you can see that it starts somewhere 1890, and we have data all the way up to 2016 now. And you have to again realize that the change in magnitude, you can see that this peaks here, this is a logarithmic scale. So you are talking about brightness variation of the factor of more than 10, maybe more in some cases. What we did was to predict such an outburst like this, that it will happen in 2015. Okay? And this is not easy, especially those who are familiar with blazars. Making predictions and then withdrawing it before the paper is published is quite common. Okay? So that's the, and what did we do? Well, so let me explain to you the properties of OJ-287. How do I know an object from such a long time, I mean compared to human life? Well, this object was discovered by Ohio Radio Survey, that's what this OJ called over, it's a 287 object in that survey. So this is this big telescope which picked up WOW signal and all that. So it's located near the ecliptic, and that's important, because for the last 150 years or so, people were looking for comets, obviously in the ecliptic, that's what we want. And so these were frequently, that portion of the sky was frequently photographed, and we have photographic plates which are archived. So you go back to get that previous figure I showed you. So we have optical observation dating back to 1819. There are huge gaps during the First and Second World War. Unfortunately, we have no record of those things, even though India, especially the Nawab, might have been observing it very clearly in Hyderabad. Unfortunately, no records. Okay, this is classified as a BL-LAC object. It's a subgroup of blazars. It's a subgroup of an active galactic nuclei. So these are technical terms. Well, BL-LAC object is an object which looks like a star called BL Lacertae. It's just a star, it looks like a star. It's a blazar because it's quasar and BL-LAC together, it's called blazar. And all this belongs to something called active galactic nuclei. And these are not in our ecliptic, they are very far away, they are essentially a gigaparsec away. That came from spectroscopic measurements, of course. Okay, and what are AGNs? Well, we heard about gravitational waves being most violent events in the universe. However, if you are looking for non-explosive events, AGNs are indeed the most powerful sources in the galaxy, in the universe. In fact, their luminosity is something of the order of trillion solar luminosity, and they can be seen up to very large distances. The current record is around 7.1, that's very far away, essentially 500,000 years, sorry, something of the order of 500 million years after Big Bang or something like that. And we are confident that the energy is coming from a very small region of the order of few light days. How are you going to say that? These objects are very far away, cosmological distances, they look like a point object. There's no way you can argue that, you know, the radiation is coming from a very tiny region. That's because we use the fact that there are violent fluctuations in their brightness, okay, and that allows us to connect, say, this violent fluctuation in the light curve to physical sizes of the object, delta T times C will give you roughly the size of the region. Okay, so that's why we can claim that all the action is happening out there in a very tiny region, few light days, and some action is happening in such a way that they can be seen at cosmological distances. These are broadband emission, they actually can be seen from radio to gamma ray wavelength, and it is actually good, especially if you have, you know, an object which is emitting 10 raised to 13 LCERN. There are very few, very rare events, only 1% of galaxies at any given epoch are experiencing active galactic nuclei phase. That is also nice. Okay, and how do you get active galactic nuclei? Well, it is postulated, and we have solid observational evidence that these are powered by massive black holes at the center of galaxies. Our own galaxy got a massive black hole. It is a million solar mass beast, but and it is actually very faint. So, the active galactic nuclei, which look like a stellar object in the sky, is shining. They are cosmological objects simply because the matter is falling into a supermassive black hole, and there are clear observations from observing with Hubble and also from radio observations. We can identify galaxies which are nearby, not at 7.1, but nearby of the order of 0.3 redshift. We can photograph them, and with Hubble and many other observatories, we can actually associate an accreting area. We can't really identify the black hole so far. So, we think that this is the AGNs are shining so brightly because of the accretion of matter into a black hole. And let me explain this word if that's not familiar to some of you. Accretion is essentially matter falling into a compact object. Any object will do. And well, matter is falling and radiation is going out. So, this is essentially the gravitational energy of an a small mass falling into a big mass from a distance r. So, then that is the energy, binding energy. So, you can convert that into a flux, energy flux or luminosity, just dot it. You can scale this up and down, it is very straightforward, and you will immediately find the accretion luminosity to be eta times m dot times c square. Okay, and this eta turned out to be around of the order of 0.1 or 0.05 if you are bringing in a black hole. If you can consider hydrogen burning, that factor of eta is essentially 0.007. So, accretion is an extremely efficient process of converting matter into radiation, and this is being happening out there. So, you can actually turn this around. I told you that AGNs have luminosity of the order of 10 raised to 13 LCERN, that is of the order of 10 raised to 46 ergs per second. So, I can actually estimate from this formula an m dot, and you will find that m dot roughly corresponds to matter falling at the rate of 1 solar mass per year. Okay, so, that is very nice. Not only that, I can bring in a quantity called Eddington luminosity. The idea is that the matter is falling and the radiation is generated. You can imagine a balance between the radiation force and the gravitational force, and that gives you a luminosity is called Eddington luminosity. And Eddington luminosity scales in this beautiful way, and you will immediately realize that if I assume the accretion luminosity of the order of that Eddington luminosity, which is of the order of 10 raised to 46, assuming that, you will immediately find the mass of the order of 10 raised to 8, 10 raised to 9 solar mass. So, another way of saying is that because of this very simple arguments, lots of dirty physics there, but back of the envelope calculation, this is good enough, that active galactic nuclei are powered by matter falling into massive black holes. So that can be fairly easily established and substantiated by observations. Okay, and it turned out that there's a number of AGNs. Actually, the zoo is very, very complicated. I am not an expert on this. There are radio quiet AGN, there are radio loud AGN. They have been divided into subclasses and additional subclasses and all that. It is a very active area of research across the wavelength. Okay, KP works on these things, and also very active collaborations going in NCRA and others in radio. The point is that you can actually use three parameters to explain all this variety, at least theoretically. They will not fit exactly. A viewing angle, you are seeing an object, so naturally the line of sight will come into the picture. If there are radio jets are there, I will just show you that. If it is radio loud, it is actually visible in radio or not, radio wavelengths, and the accretion rate. Okay, so people do play around with these parameters to explain. In that model, I have been talking about matter falling into a supermassive black hole to explain this AGN activities, and under the zoo I am talking about. So this cartoon essentially tries to, and this is actually by Martin Rees and Roger Blanford, I should have given the. So again, BLASA, as I told you, it is a quasar plus a BLAC type object, that is called BLASA. They are characterized by rapid variability, so, and then high and variable polarization more than 10%, and essentially we have confidence to argue that we are looking directly into the jet I have been talking about. So the picture is that this is a supermassive black hole at the center of some galaxy, and it is gobbling up matter, and the matter forms an accretion disk, which is inside that. This is not the accretion disk, inside that, and it is lightening it up because the efficiency is of the order of 10 raised to minus 1, and it creates a jet. Well, that is a very complicated process, but we are confident that it is indeed creating a jet, especially if it is rotating, and that we are looking directly into that jet. Maybe a small angle between the line of our sight and the jet, 3 degrees, 4 degrees and all that. Okay. So however, if you are looking from some other direction, it will be one of those AGNs I listed in that zoo. Okay. So this qualitative picture, which is very complicated because I have to explain each and every member of that zoo, essentially fits this description that are talking about. Taurus, there are, so how do we know that these are black holes and other things? Well, when you look at the spectral lines, they are broadened. Okay, the emission lines are broadened, velocity broadening. So the matter which is creating those spectral lines are moving with velocities which are 1,000 km/s. Okay, and so there are lots of observation. I mean, it's been an active area for the last 50 years or so. Good. So this is the picture, again a cartoon. You have the black hole at the center, you have the accretion disk which is fairly hot, it is of the order of 1,000,000 Kelvin or something like that, and the jet, and if you directly look into the jet, it will appear like a blazar to you. Okay, so that's, now so far I have been talking about observing blazars and modeling them as matter falling into a single black hole. Now here is a blazar, and as I told you, this is OJ 287, 287 member of this Ohio Jansky radio survey. This is the observation I was talking about. When you look at it carefully, this is V magnitude as a function of time starting from 1890 onwards. You see this double peaks, which are more common now. So you see some sort of a quasi-periodic structure in this light curve. There are two of them. So, and then when you look very carefully using the data from last 30 years or so, these peaks are, there are earlier part we can't really see there were double peaks, but as you come closer and closer, the peaks actually can be individually separated into two peaks. They are roughly 2 years apart, and if you carefully look at it, you will see a long term variation of the order of 60 years. And more importantly, last 30 years observation and many nature papers show that this outburst events suddenly happens. Okay, so this is the picture which Mori and his collaborators were trying to model in 20 years ago. And Mori and his student figured out that there are certain outburst season. This is what, again, V magnitude as a function of year, but now it's pointing to 1983 83.5, and there will be nothing there because it's behind the sun. 1994 94.5, you will see that there are these giant flares and there are broad flares. These are the things they were trying to explain. So the fact that there were these giant flares which come in a pair forced them to argue that maybe you need a companion. So they went through a system of arguments and came up with this beautiful mathematical argument. Well, you can construct a simple mathematical rule to explain already existing observation at that time. What's the rule? Well, take a Keplerian orbit. That's the orbit where, you know, sun, the earth moves around sun on a Keplerian orbit. Make it slightly eccentric if you want, and then imagine that in that orbit, this outburst I talked about, this outburst here, are produced as a constant phase angle, some part of the orbit, and at the opposite phase angle, 180 degree. Okay, take the orbit, assuming that these flares are associated with this part of the orbit or the other part of the orbit, now 180 degrees apart. That is a simple mathematical rule, and obviously it will give you two outbursts per period. That is fairly straightforward, even though I will not be able to write down analytic expression, because Keplerian prescription is not analytic because of the classic Kepler equation, and it does not matter, computers can do that. Now you choose an optimal value of eccentricity, that is up to you, because you are trying to fit the data observed at that time. Allow the semi-major axis of the ellipse to actually advance. Okay, that is important. So this is all you need. Take a Keplerian orbit, assume that or impose that the flares are happening at some phase angle and 180 degree of that phase angle. Choose an eccentricity and let the semi-major axis of the ellipse to advance. With this mathematical rule, they were trying to fit the data like this and whatever available in the literature at that time. So what does this mean? It simply means physically that you have a small black hole in orbit around a big black hole. Accretion into that big black hole is what actually fueling this quasar, this star like object, which is allowing us to follow it for the last 150 years or so. However, the secondary will come and hit this accretion disk twice an orbit. It is during that time you get these flares which have been observed at that time. Okay? So clearly the flares are repeated every cycle. However, it is not going to be periodic. Why is that? Because I am allowing the semi-major axis to advance. So I am bringing in another time scale. Okay, so it will not be periodic strictly, but it will be quasi-periodic. So immediately from the observation, I can put a bound on the precision rate, which is very nice. So this is very nice from a theoretical point of view, because if you are trying to observe a binary, you have to figure out the binary inclination, which is next to impossible if you are not doing radio observations and we have Shapiro delay and other things. Here we do not care. The fact that it is a quasar with the jet directly pointing out you, you know the inclination anyway, and this model does not care about it. And so that's very nice. So it's simpler way, and so this is the cartoon which explains what I'm trying to tell you mathematically or physical words. Essentially, you have a big black hole, and there's an accretion disk. Matter is falling into black hole, and it's a very efficient process. It's fueling that quasar. We can see it, even though the redshift is around 0.3. But it has been surrounded by another black hole, a smaller black hole, and it is in an orbit which is turning point to turning point is around 6 years. That's a 12-year orbit. And whenever it impacts the accretion disk, you get this flare. So, good thing about mathematical modeling is that this orbit can be well defined if you have 5 flares and their timings. And from the historical data and the observation up until 1995, they were able to identify those flares. So, it gives us 4 intervals. And so it's a well-defined system. So you have 4 parameters that can be fixed. Semi-major axis can be converted into the mass of that big black hole. Eccentricity you can bring in to fit the data. Orbital precision rate, that's what makes it quasi-periodic. And then there is an initial phase angle. You have to integrate the system from some initial value. So that's a free parameter. You can also fix that. It's mathematically, it's essentially argument of the upper center, but that's just the technical term. Good. However, this is not sufficient. It's not a binary pulsar, which is a very clean system. It's a dirty system. Okay? The flare starts very suddenly, that we know for sure. And the rise time is roughly of the order of a day in those days. Okay? So that's an observational So then Maury and his collaborators looked into literature and earlier investigation. So the argument is that if the black hole impacts the accretion disk, it will create a huge bubble of gas, and the bubble will arise from that accretion disk. It will become optically thin after some time after the impact, and that's the time we will see it as a flare. Okay? And the radiation, because this is an arresting radiation, is thermal Bremsstrahl, and the radiation is around 10 raised to 5 Kelvin, which is in the soft X-ray, which is important for theoretical consideration when you ask for time of big space observatories. So this is the additional theoretical or astrophysical input I have to bring in, which makes the system a bit dirty too. Okay, so but there are, once you bring in some astrophysical aspect, it will have implication. So I told you blazar, the radiation is highly polarized. The fact that I have a Bremsstrahl-Lang radiation of low polarization ensures that during the impact flare happening, the average polarization will be below than the usual, you know, polarization of blazar radiation. So that's actually an important piece of puzzle for us to solve from observation. So however, I told you that the black hole hits the accretion disk, but the flare will happen after some time. So that's a free parameter. I have no information about that. So that's turned out to be a free parameter initially. So obviously you have 5 free parameters. To fix from observation, and that's precisely what they did in 1996. So they have observations. In 2005, they actually picked up these well-timed outbursts 47, 72, 83, 84, 94, and 2005. So this was the 5 observations they were running after, and they that allowed them to actually describe the orbit of that black hole binary. So naturally we can make predictions. So this is an exciting area. If you are a theoretician, you have an astrophysical model for an object out there in the universe, you will like to make a prediction. That's natural to you. It's an exciting thing to do. Even though this is a very dirty system, it's not a binary pulsar where I can time each pulsar arrival time up to microsecond accuracy. That's not going to happen here.
What's the supposed mass of this second
lens? Okay, so I will list that. I mean, okay, it can be extracted from observation. It turned out to be around 100 million solar mass. This is to fit the observation. It's extracted from that. And Murray also has some astrophysical arguments for that, which is an interesting thing in itself. So again, they did this prediction paper somewhere in 2006, predicting next outburst of OG-287. And this is what they happened. So the prediction was that such an impact flare will happen on 13 September 2007, plus or minus 2 days. This prediction was made in 2005-2006, and this is the observed flux rise. This is the theoretical curve, and you will see that there are these outliers, and that's the problem with this observation. It's not an isolated clean system. However, the observed flux rise coincided with the observed, you know, prediction for almost 6 hours. And if you can compare that, it's the accuracy is almost the same as what we predicted about the return of Halley's Comet in 1986, which is very nice. So, and that's good enough to bring it into Nature. So Maury and his collaborators published this in Nature, and that time he was trying to bring in the effect of general relativity in a very crude manner. So he actually told me that some of his runs, if you remove the effect of gravitational wave emission, which is happening at so-called 2.5 PN order, then the predicted outburst will happen on September 20th or something like that, 28th or something like that. And it came in the big news as BBC covered it, and there were lots of interviews. I was not part of any of this. So I went to Turku for some Pusnutonian lectures, and Maury walked in. We had lots of discussion about this, and at that time LISA was being pushed very hard, and this system will actually emerge in 10,000 years. So a natural candidate for LISA kind of system anyway. So again, this is the model at that time. So you have a small black hole plunging into the accretion disk of a big black hole, 100 million solar mass. So this is around 18 billion solar mass. It's an eccentric orbit around 0.6. The flares are happening when the impacts occurs. And this is the cartoon that it's a precessing orbit, and that precession comes from GR, and it's actually consistent with Pusnutonian description if you are very careful about the implementation. So in 2008-2009, we sat down to ask these questions: can we do better? Because so far the predictions occurred in 2007, the impact flare came, so we would like to do it better. At that time, Maury had a student from West Indies, Ram Padath, Indian origin, West Indian student. So he was sent to this Harvard plates, archive plates, to look for outburst of OG-287, and he came up with an outburst around 1957. And so, and there were tentative observations for few other. It is a huge collection. It took him almost 6 months to go through painstakingly and figuring it out. So then it turned out that by 2009 there was something like 9 observed outbursts times which we can extract. So can we do better? So I argued that maybe we should let the primary black hole to spin. So far Maury modeled this as non-spinning binary black hole system. So excuse me. So I argued that maybe we should bring in the spin to the primary black hole. Then obviously and I have some interest in general relativistic prescription of black hole binaries. So I argued that we should actually bring in this description very accurately, taking care of subtleties and all that. That turned out to be very useful. So if you have an accurate description of this relativistic orbit of this black hole binary, then obviously it will allow us to constrain parameters of the system very accurately. I'm not going to make the statement that let the orbit precess. I'm not going to make the statement. I'll say this is my mathematical rule. I will provide the equation. Let the outburst time be consistent with the solution. Hence, I will extract from my solution the masses. Okay? So I don't need to make those mathematical rules. It comes naturally if I use this GR description, and which will also allow us to make predictions. And so this is what I, this was my contribution. Essentially, we introduced this post-Newtonian description, which essentially corrections to Newtonian dynamics in terms of this small parameter. And then we have to do a bit more. We argued that the orbital plane precesses around the spin vector. So you have a black hole binary, you have a vector for the orbit, and also the black hole is spinning, so you have a spin for that. So we argued that let the angle between orbital angular momentum and spin to be a constant. And then we argued that the precessional cone should be aligned with the accretion disk axis. This has something to do with astrophysical arguments. Hence, we were able to make a solution to the description, and we were able to make a prediction. So this is the essentially, so ignore this astrophysics argument. That's something Mori came up later. So if you look at the orbital description, it says that M1 is of the order of something like 19 billion solar mass. The other one is around 100 million solar mass. The spin parameter should be around 0.28 plus or minus 0.03 at that time. Of the curve, 1 is the maximum, that is the curve parameter. Eccentricity around 0.7. This alpha is the dimensionless time delay I was talking about. Here it is something to do with the viscosity. And then there is a parameter called Q. This is to test so-called Noether theorem. That's something technical. Okay. So essentially, we in 2010 we predicted that there should be an outburst around 2015, late 2015, which is very nice because this time of the year, OJ-287 can be followed. It comes up fairly, around 2 o'clock or something like that, and we said. Argued that we played around with this equation. That's a good thing about having post-Newtonian equation. We argued that the value of the spin is going to be defined by when this flare will happen. So we had a fitting formula for the spin, something like that. So T is the time beginning of the outburst in year. So 2016, if it happens, that's 0, you get 0.25. But if you happen early, it will change. So again, what we argued that if you can time this flare very accurately, we should be able to measure. So let me emphasize that we are measuring it. We are not estimating it. We are measuring it because we have observation. We have something to fit. However, in gravitational wave observation, we are only estimating the spin of the final black hole. We have a formula. We fit that. We don't at this in our observation, we were not able to measure, but in this era of publicity, we don't really distinguish these two things, but that's okay. So again, I told you a campaign was initiated somewhere last year this time. So it involved of the order of 2 dozen observatories and the SIFT satellite. So again, we need a document to justify these observations. So that was created. We kind of pass it around and all that. Okay. In fact, this is what we call as a Christmas tree outburst. So in fact, the optical outburst indeed came, and we realized that by the late October, things were happening. So this was going on. The way to do this is we have a companion, a comparison star, which is fairly stable. So people observe with optical telescopes, you need a 1 meter class is good enough. So you know, it was covered from essentially from observatories in Japan, Korea, China was missing, India, Hawaii in Europe. So again, those document was used to get the, you know, because this is a small object, you don't need lots of time. You only integrate it for something like 30 minutes, you get a good point for a day. That's good enough for us. Okay, so the major outburst involved, as I told you earlier, a rapid rise to a narrow peak. And Mori has this experience that always there will be a slowly rising part and then an additional peak, like these things are also expected. However, this fit was created from this model where you have an uniform sphere which is expanding sphere of plasma and Abramsdale long radiation from that. That's what the thing was going on, and the fit was somewhat pretty okay. Yes.
How much is the decay?
Oh, decay, again the problem is here.
So how many days?
Oh, this went on till almost to Christmas time. But in the sense of, you know, it went all the way up to 12.9, I think it went back to something like 14 or something by end of New Year or something like that.
Does the spin of a smaller black hole matter or not?
Not really. I can put that to be 1 or 0.5, the solution hardly matters. That's simply because the mass ratio is huge, it's factor of 1000. So even that kind of sensitivity we don't have. Even if you replace this system with a binary pulsar, it will not matter. Factor of 1000 is not going to help, you know, will kill you, that effect. So oh, so this is essentially thermal Bramston Lang. The other one is essentially the synchrotron, which is what you expect from a jet.
Why isn't the synchrotron present other times?
It's always present.
Why do you see it there?
Which one?
See, there looks like a second peak after the first one.
This one? So, okay. So, the argument is that the companion brings in tidal interaction. It actually changes the mass accretion flow. Okay, so the m dot fluctuates, tidal interaction, so it provides this subsidiary flares. And how do you know that those are not, how do you know that this is not the impact flare, maybe this is the impact flare? This is where the next slide, you look for the polarization. Okay, so these are synchrotron, very high polarization, whereas this peak was actually of reduced polarization, and this is something which we were missing in earlier optical observation, obviously. So this is why the model is somewhat problematic to many. How do I know that this is the flare? Could be something else, right? And there are all sorts of flares, I can show you that. There are, as correctly pointed out, there are many flares from the system, not of this significant magnitude. I could say that, put it there, my solution will change. So you have to identify the peak carefully, and that obviously comes from the experience, fine tuning sometimes, which is problematic. So, but the system is dirty, I can't do anything more.
Is it, I understood correctly, it is around 11 or 12 years, right? That is
the, yes, that's right.
So if you are taking that, then the smaller black hole is penetrating from one side.
Correct.
And coming from the other one.
Yes.
Well,
good question. So at that time, we were after, when it was coming from under, if you are thinking in that way, we were trying to get the spectrum of this guy, okay? Because if we can identify, if I assume that the smaller black holes as also an accretion disk, smaller one or something like that, if we can get some emission lines, and from that maybe we should be able to see it's associated with the second black hole. And also, if the second black hole was around, it should give you intraday variability. So, in fact, we launched such a program a couple of years back. Unfortunately, it was all washed out. So, we were hopping on IGO that went down. Our collaborators could not come together. There were all sorts of problems. So intraday variability will not be there for this big black hole. It will be there for the small black hole. So we were supposed to get spectrum from Hubble, but unfortunately Hubble will only take the spectrum when it flyers, and we are not interested in that, because during flyer the spectrum is featureless, because even if there is any emitting gas along the line of sight, this gamma boosting will just kill it, so we can't see anything. So this is the important thing. So in fact, when we got lots of time in SWIFT, which is an American observatory, is an X-ray. So there was a modest X-ray flyer, that's very important. However, that flyer correlated well with excess flyer emission. So this is the thing, it's not really mine. The argument is that there is an optical excess emission, which is you take the total observed optical flux and then subtract the Bremsstrahlung flux, which you can estimate from optical polarization data. So he has a prescription for doing that, and he and his X-ray colleagues can show that data from the SWIFT daily monitoring, so you don't get to do this very often, confirm major thermal component of this outburst, and that's a crucial for us to do the calculation. So timing of the rise of the thermal component immediately give me an arrival time. I could immediately estimate from that the spin of the massive black hole. Remember, I had that fit formula. And more importantly, as I told you, when we have a good general relativistic prescription of the binary, our accuracies will improve. Now the system properties are under control up to 2%. It was something like 10%, like LIGO observation in 2007. Now we are at 2%. And this is the cartoon we come up with. So again, this is the accretion disk. The guy comes and gives you the flyer, and it will keep happening. Okay, we have a spin now, and you can see this is a very compact system. Maybe we should be able to test Nohaier theorem. So far we are only talking about binary black hole or black hole candidates. Black hole in GR is characterized by so-called Nohaier theorems, in the sense that you only need mass and spin to describe any black holes. Any deformation can be explained in terms of mass and spin. That's the Nohaier theorem. Nohaier is deformation which requires specific equation of state, obviously. Black hole does not need that. So that's what, and nobody has done it. LIGO cannot do it for the time being. It will be done in the advanced LIGO, in LIGO India regime, where we will find many black hole quasi normal modes and things like that. But this decade it will be difficult. Maybe we can do it. However,
yeah. Hawking is now talking a lot of soft hair.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the difference. That will end up giving you dipole radiation and things like that. But I'm talking purely classical results. I'm not bringing in classical results from textbooks, not new results. Okay, so. So let me just go back to this table here. So this is a parameter called Q, which essentially comes into Pusnewtonian equation, and that quantity is only 30% bounded for the time being. Okay, so the Q actually defines a quadrupole moment of that primary black hole, which we know that has to be related to the Kerr parameter in a very specific manner. The dimensionless Q has to be minus chi square, okay, and that if you so we can put a parameter, put it in the equation and see, let the observation constrain it. Okay, so it's exactly the same way Norbert and others are trying to do this with a pulsar in the galactic center. There, what the idea will be in that case, you have this quasi periodic terms in the Raumer time delay, again characterized by a Q, and that Q is a contrapole moment, and you define a parameter and search whether that is 1 or not, 1 times minus chi square. Okay. So, it comes from the equations short. Okay. So, can we do anything better? Well, there are ongoing projects, actually Langevin Day is involved in one of them. So, it turned out that, and Maria is not going to be happy about it, this system can actually constrain dipole, certain kind of dipole radiation, and that is precisely what she is trying to do with the LIGO observations. And it turned out that there will be scenarios where the binary black hole will be first seen in LISA, and it will disappear from LISA, it will come in LIGO. That time we should be able to constrain this dipole radiation amazingly. It turned out that our back of the envelope calculation show that OJ-287 should be able to do better even than that. Well, that is something, and we are also exploring variations in G, that is big Newtonian constant, with the timing. It is a ongoing thing, it will take a while. We are also exploring whether higher order spin effects will have any implication about the prediction and all that. Well, as I told you, this is where the technological things will walk in. The next predicted outburst is going to happen somewhere in July 14 to July 17, and that is where OJ-287 will be too close to the sun. Sun moves around the ecliptic, right? So, ground observation will be very, very difficult. We argued actually that the new horizon, the Pluto Express should look at it. That's not going to fly. They are not going to give us time to do this kind of stupid thing. So, that's a problematic thing. However, you know, solar guys can help us. Maybe something can cook up. So, there's something. It will be a real technological challenge. But I'm more interested in something else. So, there will be an effort which is actually picking up pace these days. It's called Event Horizon Telescope. These are huge radio telescopes where you have observation is in gigahertz, okay, 10 gigahertz or something like that. So, they are networking them. They are in America, Australia, Korea, now building one in the Greenland, in South Pole, you know, and they are connecting all of them as an interferometer. They should be able to resolve 50 micro arc second level. Okay. Now, with that kind of high frequency, you look at the galactic center, this is what you are expected to see. This is from a simulation from the, I just forgot the name, is in perimeter these days. So, this is the shadow of the black hole. So, you want to image the shadow of the black hole and see how the shadow is deformed to pick up the spin of the black hole and other things, and also test Noether theorem. So, the predicted sensitivity looks something like this. This shadow arises because you have an accreting matter into the black hole, and that, so the light emitted will be gravitationally bent into this very aura like that, but you will see Doppler effects of matter flowing towards you and moving away from you and things like that. So, this will be done during this decade, and eventually they are planning to bring in telescope from space. At that time we will have an interest in that. Angular diameter of a non-rotating black hole, it's there's a square root of 3 missing because you have to bring in the fact that there's accretion and all that. It's around 6 gm by c square d, d is the distance, and this is around 3 micro arc second. So, that will not be possible this decade, but eventually it will happen. However, we have been talking to these people and arguing whether we can measure this astrometric displacement when the black hole plunges into the accretion disk and things like that. It is something ill defined from our point, their point. So, it is a blazar, they are not too sure what is going on. So, something is, some chat is going on. And also, unfortunately, the gravity in VLTI is helpless. They don't have a guide star nearby, so we can't do anything on that. Okay, and the fact that there's a supermassive black hole binary shows that there will be nanohertz gravitational waves. This system is actually emitting nanohertz gravitational waves, and that's a very good news for the pulsar timing array guys. Unfortunately, the amplitude, the measurable quantities of the order of something order of few nanoseconds, that's the delay it will cause, that's too small. We need of the order of 50 nanoseconds for the time being. So it's actually, anyway, the fact that there is a binary black hole system out there is sort of encouraging. And so naturally, this is a continuous source of gravitational wave, and that's where the daily monitoring of IPTA pulsars will be important, and that's precisely what Tata pulsar timing array that we are pushing is going to do eventually if it's funded properly. So obviously we can, and Tapta telescopes can look into high frequency regime, 10 gigahertz, not a problem. That's where we can also couple them to the Event Horizon telescope. So again, this will be something interesting. That's all. Let me summarize. So the predicted flare indeed establish the presence of this massive black hole binary system in OJ-287. We have an accurate measurement of the spin of this massive black hole, which turned out to be 1/3 of the Kerr parameter value. Again, we have established GI properties of the system roughly at the 2% level. I think that's all I want to say. Thank you. Happy Diwali.
Thanks for the exciting colloquia. So maybe there is a question.
Yeah, you talked about the actual prediction of the flare, but what happens to the intensity? I saw some.
Yes. Okay, so if you are talking about, so let me go back to this. This is the one you are talking about, whether the intensity keep moving. This is the 60 year time scale. Is that what you are? I'm sorry? Well, there is some sort of normalization because these are from historical plates and other things. There is an explanation for that. Because if you have a companion, the theta, the beaming angle will slowly change, and that will change the Doppler factor. You remember this Doppler factor gamma 1 minus cos theta beta raised to minus 1 and all that, that will slowly change. It can actually modulate the flux density we are going to see. So it is consistent with that time scale too. It's actually consistent with the post-Newtonian time scale around 70 years, additionally this effect too. So we actually pointed out that in one of the papers. That is essentially due to the small fluctuation in theta, which modulates into the, in fact, Mori was arguing that maybe this is what the star of Bethlehem, but that's something we can only speculate. So, because we know there's a steady decrease of the base level of this blazar, this is well established. So if you extrapolate, it will actually look like a beautiful star. So, and it turned out, I actually did this integration back, and it came roughly around, you know, when the Jesus was born. So.
Isn't it about almost the last slide?
I love to do that. Oh, yeah, sure.
Because all these pulsar timing things are connected with
background
stochastic
gravitation. Sure,
waves.
Fully agree.
OJ-287 is a single source, and it's very far away, in fact.
Precisely.
So, it will be very difficult to detect this kind of thing with, in fact, it will be, the amplitude will, these also depend upon the amplitude of the gravitational waves. If it's so far away, then how can you expect to detect single point sources of light?
Precisely. Okay. So the first expected nanohertz gravitational wave observation most likely will be from a gravitational wave background. Maybe cosmological, maybe massive black hole binary systems and all that. However, if you have daily monitoring, that's going to improve the continuous gravitational wave sources like black hole binaries in eccentric orbit with higher harmonics and everything. In that context,
in our galaxy.
No, not in our galaxy. So for example, if OJ-287, the mass ratio was of the order of 10, not 1000, we could have seen it already. Okay, because the gravitational wave strength comes with this eta, the dimensionless parameter, which is of the order of q, if you want that. I mean, so it is of the order of 10 raised to minus 3 now. So if you are there's something like 0.1 or something, factor of 10 between the two masses, then the current data is good enough to pick up this guy. Unfortunately, it's not. So yes, the gravitational wave background most likely will be the first source, but eventually when the SKR and other things, they will look for individual gravitational wave sources, and we know that there are lots of, I'm not talking about within the galaxy, outside, there are plenty of literature on that. In fact, Vikram Ravi's son is actually working on such things too. So accretion disk, it essentially ejects
with velocity
something like 0.7. Yeah, it will be very high. It's
quite large.
It's not 0.7, it's actually the post Newtonian factor is of the order of something 10 raised to minus 2 or something. Off my head, I can't remember. So, the velocity of the black, so it actually ejects a piece of accretion disk along with it. Oh, yes,
obviously.
That's right, precisely.
So, and how it is happening? It strikes at certain distance,
Okay.
And how did that mass is increased to the center of the
planet? Okay, maybe I will give this. So, the game is that this guy, it's directly pointing out to you, does not matter whether it comes above and below you. The observation is from the jet coming from the center mass black hole. The flare, there is no way, so when it goes out or something like that, it, you know, it kicks the mass out, okay, and it will be optically thick obviously for the time being, and it takes us some time to cool, then it comes out, okay. That has nothing to do with this.
Probably it must be accretion on the center.
Yes. So the system is visible to you because of the mass accretion into primary. On addition to this, you have this flare contributing to that the synchrotron jet radiation, and you try to identify this flare. And that is the challenge.
But in order for that to happen, is it really necessary that the secondary must have an accretion disk?
There is no need. We do not.
Without that, then how do you achieve all this, this flare?
Then it is the matter ejected from the accretion disk of the primary. Okay, and again, this black hole, right now we do not put it as a, you know, we do not put any accreting matter onto that, but we have seen this is another puzzle in this observation. We have seen intraday variability consistent with 100 million solar mass black hole, and how do you explain that from this object? We can't resolve obviously. So the argument is that then this jet radiation is dominated by the secondary. Okay, so we only see the jet. We have to extract everything from that. Sometimes the jet is dominated by matter, you know, either falling into this, and this happens prior to the impact or just after that, and there has been observation.
So in this case, when it is coming from the web side, right? You know yet, right?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Questions I want to ask you. Oops.
Okay.
Maybe it is not related, but a little bit of what this Tapta telescope is, and can you describe a little?
Well, actually, this was supposed to be a series of talks. Balchandra was supposed to come and talk about Tapta, and he will talk about it. So, it's essentially TCL has bunch of telescopes very close to GMRT. So, we want to use them and to look at pulsars, bunch of millisecond pulsars, which we can do, and that will be, it will be connected, connected, and it will be a dish of roughly 50 meter, 50. There are three of them, we can connect them, which is what GMRT guys are very good at. With that, we should be able to monitor this 20 pulsars. IPTA would like to do, International Pulsar Timing Array would like to follow. Right now they can do it once in 3 weeks, we should be able to do once in every day, which is very good news for continuous gravitational waves, and this is a system like this is what we are looking into, not this system unfortunately. Thank you. Beautiful. Oh, yeah, sure.